The Supreme Court's decision on the Affordable Care Act is due out at the end of the month, and what's poised to be a dramatic ruling with implications about what the Supreme Court is, how we feel about it, and where it's headed. That's no matter what the decision is. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're joined by two guests this hour. First is Jill Lepore. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and her article is called Benched, the Supreme Court and the Struggle for Judicial Independence, which appears in this week's issue. And then we'll pick up with Dahlia Lithwick, who writes the jurisprudence column at Slate.com. And we'll be talking with her about the media and the Supreme Court and what the court could look like in the future. And we want to know what you think. Do you see the Supreme Court as a political entity? Do you approve of the job that the court's been doing recently? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@WPR.org. And Jill Lepore, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, your article in The New Yorker gets at the history of the court around the Commerce Clause and also, as you say, the struggle for judicial independence. So to get us rolling, how independent is the Supreme Court right now?
Right now, the Supreme Court is very independent from the other two branches of government. The question, I guess, that seems to be on a lot of people's minds, if you look at the most recent polls, is how independent the Supreme Court justices as individuals are, or the court as a whole, are from the political process and the political culture in which we live. And we can't, of course, expect there to be complete independence or some kind of complete separation between law and politics. But the point of my article is really just to call attention. I'm an American historian. The point of my article is call attention to the long struggle for judicial independence. This is not, it's of course on everyone's radar right now because this is a very big decision coming down that will affect a lot of people's lives, and it's very visible and has been much discussed. But this, the principles at stake have been there from the start.
Well, frame that history for us as we begin in your article. Well, as far as the struggle goes, how would you say it began and led to?
Well, in many ways, it begins in 17th century England when Parliament is really trying to begin to wrest some kinds of political authority from the crown. In the legal tradition that American colonies inherited from Britain involved very little separation of powers. The courts and the legislature, in many ways, were really extensions of the crown. The great political revolutions of 17th century England are about attempts, especially on the part of Parliament, to separate itself from royal authority. So in the colonies, the court, members of the courts, the justices who served on the courts, were often the same people as the men who served on the upper house of the colonial legislatures, which were appointed by the governor. So the king would appoint the governor would appoint his royal council, the governor would appoint members of the bench whose appointments would be at the pleasure of the king. And the whole thing was really understood by the 18th century by British American colonists as really rather a pernicious one, because if you think about it, it's exactly the situation that the we would immediately see now from our vantage the problems with, right? So if the governor disagrees with how the Supreme Court has ruled, the governor could simply remove somebody from the bench without having to give cause, because the governor was royally appointed and the governor is acting on behalf of the king. This was really reformed in England in the 17th century, but that reform didn't extend to the colonies. So you had all kinds of really kind of pernicious, kind of mercantile, mercenary governors who would use the court system to their own economic gain, and there would be no recourse on the part of the people because the governor could just appoint his cronies to the courts to rule in his favor for his own political ends and often even for his own financial ends. So a big complaint that the colonists had in the 1750s, 1760s, and 1770s leading up to the Revolution, it's in the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson writes about the Declaration of Independence, the courts can't be, justice can't depend on the king's will alone. What the colonists were agitating for was to have the same status that had been extended to the courts in England, which was that justices would be appointed essentially for life as a way to prevent the king from removing justices at his whim. So that's where we get our notion that justices, that's why the Supreme Court justices today are appointed for life. It's a way to protect the justice system from the executive branch. That, of course, was adopted in the Constitution. That's how we came to have these particular kinds of judicial appointments that we have at the Supreme Court level. But a lot of people regretted it very soon after, and Jefferson famously in the beginning of the 19th century, and I think it's about 1816, he writes a letter in which he says, okay, actually that reform was really important when we had a monarchy, because, you know, there's such a kind of perniciousness to a monarchy. But in a republic, we actually just, lifetime appointments are wrong because they defy the public will. And that really has been kind of the debate all along about the nature of judicial independence.
And we consider that sacred now that the Supreme Court justices serve for life, but there's an interesting story in here that I hadn't known about the battle with the Supreme Court during the New Deal programs and how they were seen by the White House as doddering. They wanted them to get out of the way and pass this New Deal legislation. And so, you know, the Supreme Court was really taken on at that point.
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of things that we think of as sacred, sort of timeless truths of American politics, you know, we understandably think about them that way. They've been around for a long time. But one of the great comforts of studying history is realizing that things change a lot, and there's a lot of room for change. Even the number of justices has changed. They were initially five, then there were six, then there were nine, then there were ten. And in 1935, FDR proposed adding another six. The number of justices is not determined by the Constitution, nor is the Supreme Court's right to rule federal laws unconstitutional. That's not part of the Constitution. These are developments that have a kind of accreted over time, and there have been different views about them over time. It's not unlike, for instance, we take as a kind of timeless, sacred political truth that our votes should be secret, right? That we have a secret ballot. Like when, you know, we go to the polling place, we pull the curtain behind us, no one can see how we vote. No one has a right to see that. That's a relative novelty in American political history. That didn't start till the end of the 19th century. Before then, everyone would have thought that would have been apostasy, that would have been the most cowardly kind of thing of all, that your vote had to be open. Was it a defining notion of American politics up until really the 1880s. So a lot of things that we think of as kind of timeless, like the number of justices or judicial review, the ability of the Supreme Court to review acts of Congress and decide on their constitutionality, these are accreted changes that have happened over time.
And can you tell us the story during the New Deal with the Supreme Court?
Yeah. So FDR was elected by a landslide when he came to office, and he used that mandate to push through Congress 15 acts of legislation, federal legislation, all having to do with the regulation of the economy very, very quickly. He wanted a new deal for Americans. He thought that really dramatic action, federal legislative action was necessary to get Americans out of the Depression. And the justification for this legislation relied on a particular kind of interpretation of the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which had been used not a whole lot before then, but was used sort of beginning in the 1890s to justify some trust-busting legislation and some kind of federal activity and federal engagement with commerce. That is the regulation of trade between states, but kind of thinking about it broadly, FDR used that understood that to be the legal underpinnings of the New Deal. Well, the court initially, you know, kind of offered some support for these rulings. Well, maybe it's an economic emergency, we can do a couple of these things. But then in 1935 struck down unanimously a number of key provisions of the New Deal. FDR, reeling from this, decided that there was a political solution at hand, which had been used before by others, which was to redefine the Supreme Court by adding new justices. There had been a book had come out that talked about how so many people on the Supreme Court were so old, and the Supreme Court was really inefficient. The book was called The Nine Old Men, and it was really widely reprinted in American newspapers. So everyone's sort of thinking, oh, the Supreme Court is like these doddering old guffers, and we need to rejuvenate the Supreme Court. So FDR proposed what came to be called the court packing plan, that anybody over the age of 70 needed to have like a backup. So there would be, at that point, there were six justices who, including the Chief Justice, Charles Evans Hughes, who were over the age of 70. Well, this really backfired for FDR. His actual approval rating, which had been very, very high, began to plummet, and Hughes fought back very deftly by writing a memo in which he explained that the more justices they had, the slower the court would work. In fact, the court slowness was not their problem. So this big fracas where it's not unlike this moment in the sense that it gave people the opportunity to see the political machinations between the branches of government, between the executive and the judicial branches in particular, and how that nexus of power works. It turned out that FDR was quite successful in spite of his approval ratings falling. He was, you know, he'd been reelected by a landslide. He did actually have an enormous amount of popular support. And the court then reversed its course. And there's a debate among historians and legal scholars about whether the court reversed its course because they're just intimidated by FDR. It's like a brushback pitch, you know, and then they're just shy of the ball and they end up striking out. Or whether there really was a lot of precedent that the court was using in shifting, changing its mind. But in any case, in 1936, the court, beginning in late 1935, the court began upholding the New Deal.
So in 1936, the idea that you could redefine what the Supreme Court was something that was not outside the realm of possibility. What if someone wanted to do something like that now? Is it still possible to redefine the court, or have we reached the point where this is what the court is and you better not mess with it?
Well, you know, there's a kind of one truism of American politics is that when you ask people, can we change the Constitution, or could we do something like change an American political institution that appears not to be working well? Opinion polls will tell you, no, that's not possible. But then when you use those same polls to ask people what they know about why it works the way it does and what would be, in fact, be required to change it, people know very little. So we have this kind of instinctive, oh, no, we couldn't possibly change that. That's what American greatness is based in. You know, these traditions are ancient, and they date back to this original moment in which everything kind of coalesced, this moment of brilliance in Philadelphia, and it's immutable. That is not usually buttressed by a great familiarity, because, of course, that is not to say people should know. It would be great if people know more, but people haven't generally studied this stuff. So it's this kind of interesting disconnect. I do think it would be very difficult to have a frank and helpful conversation about what to do about this today, partly because our political system is completely contaminated by moneyed interests. There would be so much lobbying for particular results that would have to do with who could afford to pay money to persuade people in one direction or another, that I don't think, be particularly confident that we would have an outcome that would reflect either the popular will or a kind of principled evaluation of the political forces at play.
Well, as we wait for this decision on the Affordable Care Act, you know, in mind of your article and the struggle for judicial independence, what's going through your mind as you wait for this decision?
Well, you know, historians, we take sort of a vow that we will never prophesy. it's like a Hippocratic oath.
But I guess what will the various outcome, as such as they may be in terms of what the court decides to do, what will that say as you look at what the options could be?
What will it say about how people feel about the court?
About how people feel about the court and about the direction the court is moving in terms of review and in terms of, you know, as you said, moneyed interest, any of that.
Yeah. Well, I think, I suspect that the vast majority of Americans will be unhappy with whatever the court decides in this regard, partly because the court is, I would guess, somewhat likely to adopt a kind of partial solution, to sever the elements of the legislation and approve some and not others. And people are, you know, polls suggest people are pretty unhappy with the legislation as it stands. But I think people are, frankly, unhappier with the court. And the diminishing faith in American political institutions is by far, in the long term, the bigger crisis. I mean, not that the healthcare crisis isn't profound and affects people in deep and real and horrible ways every day, but the larger kind of crisis of faith in our political institutions will not be solved no matter how the court rules on this particular piece of legislation.
Well, it hinges on this Commerce Clause and how you define commerce, and this has been interpreted very broadly in the past, and it seems to be getting winnowed down and winnowed down. And you write at one point in your piece that it turns out you think the Commerce Clause is a poor branch upon which to build this nest of rights. What do you mean by that?
Well, one of the things about our constitutional culture, which is distinctive, our constitutional culture is itself distinctive, is the ways in which people seeking remedies for injustice have really the 4,400 words of the Constitution to work with, right, at the federal level. And during the Civil Rights era, one way that civil rights legislation was found to be constitutional was framed by relying on the Commerce Clause to understand certain kinds of discrimination. For instance, black only sections in restaurants or hotels that did not allow blacks to register as violations of the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. So civil rights legislation from the 1960s leaned on that clause and the broad interpretation of the Commerce Clause, which gives the federal government power to regulate traffic between the states, to extend civil rights. And that worked very effectively. It also worked very effectively during the New Deal to give the government power to regulate things like farm subsidies, the Agricultural Adjustment Act, those kinds of things. In the 1990s, the power of the Commerce Clause was struck down for the first time since the New Deal in 1995, when the Rehnquist Court ruled in U.S. v. Lopez that federal law banning the carrying of handguns, guns within 1,000 feet of a school, was an unconstitutional law because it was framed as being covered by the Commerce Clause, and the Rehnquist Court said no, there's that gun ownership and carrying a gun near a school is not an economic activity. So that was a real turning point in the interpretation of the Commerce Clause, whose definition had been broadened and broadened and broadened since really the 1880s to being more restrictive. So the test in this case is, how will the Roberts Court understand the Commerce Clause? The movement has been towards a narrowing of the Commerce Clause. And in all the ways that the kind of originalist Supreme Court culture that has a kind of popular version, too, where people are now sort of thinking, oh, yeah, well, we couldn't possibly do that. So Clarence Thomas, in his concurring opinion in one of these restricted commerce case clauses, cited Samuel Johnson's dictionary, which is, 1755 dictionary. This is kind of odd, let's find the kind of original meaning of the word commerce to describe how we could understand what is commercial activity in 2012.
Well, our guest this hour, this first half hour, is Jill Lepore. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker, and her article, Benched, The Supreme Court and the Struggle for Judicial Independence, appears in this week's issue. And we're curious about what you think about the Supreme Court. Do you see it as a political entity? Do you still have faith in the Supreme Court as one of our executive branches, as one of our branches of government? And do you approve of the job that the court has been doing recently? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 12:30, join us for Chapter Day as Norman Gilliland reads from The Girl with the Blue Beret by Bobby Ann Mason. An American World War II pilot goes back to visit the place where he was shot down over occupied Europe. This hour, we're talking about the Supreme Court as we await the decision on the Affordable Care Act. And our first guest this hour is Jill Lepore. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. And we're talking about her article, Benched, The Supreme Court and the Struggle for Judicial Independence. And we'll take our first call right now. We have with us Roland joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Roland.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I'd like you to comment on James McGregor Burns' excellent book, Packing the Court, in which Professor Burns has argued that judicial review is not in the Constitution. It was added to it by John Marshall. And he points out that the second time that, after Marbury, that was brought into play was the Dred Scott decision, which canceled the Missouri Compromise and led right into the Civil War. And after the Civil War, from the Slaughterhouse cases to the present, the Supreme Court has established itself unconstitutionally as the arbiter of so many different laws. His solution, I think, would be that if the president simply defied the Supreme Court, there would be, he said, very many learned professors writing treatises on this and calls possibly for impeachment. But if he survived that, then Congress would have to amend the Constitution with 3/4 of the states to give that right of judicial review to the country. So I'd like your opinion on James McGregor Burns' book.
Yeah, thanks very much, Roland. Yeah, it's a really interesting book, and it does do the really important work of calling our attention to the historical novelty that is judicial review. It's not in the Constitution. There's no one who would argue that it is, but we've kind of forgotten that, right? It does date to the Marshall's ruling in Marbury in 1803, in which he claimed for the court this right to review the rulings of Congress. It didn't use it again. Marshall never again declared a federal law unconstitutional. It wasn't used for 54 years, and then it was used in Dred Scott, which is probably the worst case ruling in American legal history. It remains controversial. It's really curious that conservatives gained political power in this country beginning in the 1970s, arguing against the Warren Court for its use of judicial review and claiming that it had essentially acted unconstitutional. The Warren Court was an incredibly activist court in securing civil rights through judicial activism. And conservatives gained all this political power and made the appointments to the current bench in the spirit of returning the country to the original meaning of the Constitution, and then turn out to be the most active. Roberts Court turns out to be one of the most activist courts in American history. So to sort of deploy judicial review in the name of originalism is entirely a contradiction in terms. So I think it's a really important history to call our attention to, and it's something that Lincoln called his attention to when he remarked about the ruling in Dred Scott, when he said, you know, basically, if the policy of the government upon vital questions affecting the whole people is to be irrevocably fixed by the decisions of the Supreme Court, the people will have ceased to be their own rulers. This was Lincoln's whole argument against Dred Scott. It's the argument, and FDR cited Lincoln's argument against Dred Scott when he argued against the Supreme Court in 1935. It would be possible for a president to take that position. I think it would be politically disastrous for Obama to do what James McGregor Burns suggested, which you've laid out exactly as Burns does. But it would certainly be conceivable. There have been many other remedies proposed. T.R. ran for president proposing that on the platform in 1912 of judicial recall, that the legislature ought to be basically able to fire judges. There was a proposal by a member of the U.S. Senate in 1935 who urged FDR to propose that the Constitution be amended to make judicial review possible, but only by a unanimous vote of the Supreme Court. So courts kind of actually void a federal law, it has to do so unanimously, was one of these proposals. But most of these things would require a constitutional amendment, which is quite a politically pernicious process, especially given how much money there is in politics because of the Citizens United ruling. Imagine the amount of money that would be spent to defeat a constitutional amendment.
Well, it raises a question, one of the questions you raise in your article, which is that we've never fully answered, is who checks the Supreme Court?
Right. You know, we don't know. I mean, I guess I think in your next segment you're going to be talking about the media, and I think the role of the press in having these kinds of conversations with people about the nature of political authority is a really important piece of that.
Well, Jill Lepore, we're out of time with you, but I want to thank you so much for joining us this hour. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jill Lepore, our guest this hour, she is a staff writer for The New Yorker, the author of the book The Mansion of Happiness, and this hour we were discussing her book, her article rather, Bench, the Supreme Court and the Struggle for Judicial Independence, which appeared in this week's New Yorker issue. And we'll be joined next by Dahlia Lithwick, who writes the jurisprudence column at Slate.com, and we'll be talking with her about the media and the Supreme Court and what the court could look like in the future. And Dahlia, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And tell us about how the media and the Supreme Court are interacting right now.
Well, we've had a funny little moment that I can't exactly remember in my sort of 13 years covering the court the last time I've seen this, but there's been a series of articles by some people. I think most notably Jeffrey Rosen wrote a piece at the New Republic sort of observing that were the Supreme Court to strike down President Obama's signature health care law, there would be real implications for the credibility of the court. It was not, I think, a normative piece. It was just a descriptive piece saying, you know, we know what happened after Bush v. Gore. We know what happened after Citizens United. Here's what's going to happen. We've seen the tanking poll numbers to suggest that this is going to happen. And he was met with this tsunami of criticism about how he was intimidating the justices and threatening the justices and harassing the justices. And it's launched in the last week or two this really strange conversation about, can you talk about the U.S. Supreme Court and the implications of their actions without quite literally threatening and harassing the justices themselves? And it's just a very, very odd moment. You may remember right after the Supreme Court heard the health care arguments, the president himself made comments suggesting that the court shouldn't strike it down, and that launched a week of criticism about how he was threatening and intimidating the court. So we're in a very, very funny moment where the conversation about the court is who's threatening the justices the most.
And what has the court been able to talk about how they feel about this themselves, or is this coming from outside quarters?
Yeah, this is all coming from outside quarters, and in fact, the justices would never typically respond to, you know, media fights, sort of internecine wars between liberal and conservative journalists. But the thing that I think is really interesting is that if you look back at the last few years of actual jurisprudence, that is to say, not comments made off the cuff by the justices, but actual opinions they've written, there is some sense, I think, and this is what I wrote about, that at least some of the justices are very nervous about criticism. They're very nervous about the media, and particularly the electronic media, and the potential for harassment. So I think it's not out of the realm of possibilities that the court does get nervous. They do feel that criticism could incite real retaliation at the court.
Can you give us a sense of how the American public feels about the Supreme Court right now?
Well, the best sense we have is these plummeting poll numbers. Last week, the New York Times on Friday, I believe, had a big front page story saying that 44% of Americans approve of the court. That's the lowest, I mean, that's an astoundingly high number compared to the congressional approval rates. But given the court's approval rates, which have been in the high 60s and the 50s historically, that's a really big drop. That's the lowest approval that we've seen in decades of the court.
Well, and so how do you account for that?
Well, there's an awful lot of theories. We don't know much. Certainly we know that the immediate cause of the recent tanking of the poll numbers was Citizens United, and that was the big campaign finance decision that struck down really important provisions of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act. And I think in the wake of that, the court did see, and I will say I think the court was surprised to see, a shocking, shocking number of Americans that really hated that decision. And, you know, the numbers were so, so low in terms of approval after that. Some of this may be the fallout from Citizens United, particularly now when we're seeing, you know, with the growth of super PACs and the growth of all sorts of huge, huge millionaires financing sort of secret campaign contributions. We're seeing, I think, or Americans think they're seeing the fallout from Citizens United, and they're very angry about it. I think the other piece of it really is that we had 3 days of oral argument in the healthcare cases in April, and I think there was a sense that that was a very, very partisan presentation, which is to say that the court's conservatives, you know, seem to be very, very hostile to the act. The court's liberals seem to like it. It seemed to exactly map onto their politics. And I think Americans got very, very nervous and came out thinking, I mean, the other polling we've seen is that Americans are absolutely persuaded that the court is going to hand down a partisan opinion based more on the justice's own political inclinations than the law itself.
Do you have any sense about whether that expectation of the court to be partisan, is that a new phenomenon in terms of the way the court is viewed by Americans, or has it always been that way? Have we always expected the court to be partisan?
Well, I think that's really the sort of big philosophical question that we ask ourselves, those of us who cover the courts. And I think Americans have always toggled back and forth between a very aspirational view of the court, that something magic happens when these people don their robe. You know, they're obviously political actors who are, you know, put into position by a partisan president and confirmed by a partisan Senate. So, of course, this is a political process, but I think we like to believe that the day they don their robes is the day they put that behind them, and it becomes a semi-oracular, mystical, you know, above all politics body. And I think we like to believe that. In fact, I've joked that for a secular country, we're awfully religious about the court. But I think it is also the case that we know it's a political body. We know it's a partisan body. And so I do think we toggle back and forth quite neurotically as Americans between wanting the court to be above politics, but recognizing at the end of the day it's always quite political.
Well, to bring it back to the media and the way that the media and the court have been interacting lately, I mean, is this Is this something that you're worried about as someone who reports on the court, that on the one hand, we still pussyfoot around the court and allow them to, not allow them, but, you know, there's this talk about threatening the court and threatening the justices. But on the other hand, we also have started to see them as a political entity, the Supreme Court. I mean, how do you toggle between those two about how much respect to grant them if they're a partisan body?
It's a real problem, and I think there's nobody who's more caught on the horns of that problem than the reporters who cover the court, because those of us who cover the court like to believe that it's not a partisan body. We like to believe we're not covering Congress. We go into arguments having read thousands of pages of briefs and all the footnotes, and we want to believe that something quite different is going on than simply voting the justices' preferences. That said, you know, Jeff Toobin at The New Yorker recently, you know, sort of dropped a very, very ideological piece about how Citizens United was decided, and essentially said it was a completely partisan ideological split at the court. And, you know, at the same time, I think mainstream media that covers the court tends to almost mystify it too much and to try to drain out any notion that this is a political enterprise. So I think reporters ourselves are really caught between, do we call this what it is? Some conventions, for instance, we like to say Justice Kagan appointed by a Democrat. So there are some conventions where we shorthand the idea in our reporting that this is a political enterprise. But most of the time, I think we like to just talk about the law as the law, as a sort of neutral thing that the judges apply neutrally. So I think even within any one piece one reads about the Supreme Court done by a Supreme Court reporter, one sees both of those themes kind of come out and be braided together and then separated. So I think it's just something that is endemic to this particular beat.
Well, we do have this romantic notion about justice being blind, and I think all of us have grown up watching movies where the big defining moment is a Supreme Court case, and it does have a mystical quality to it, and it seems like maybe as a nation we're sort of refining how we view the Supreme Court.
Well, it's worth pointing out that we are in a very strange moment in this country, because we are seeing for the first time a Supreme Court where all the conservatives were appointed by Republicans and all the liberals were appointed by Democrats. So Justice John Paul Stevens, who left the bench and was replaced by Elena Kagan, was the last person on the court. Before him, Justice Souter, who, although he was appointed by a Republican president, turned out to be pretty reliably liberal. And as long as you had that crossover at the court for the last few decades, where you couldn't say every single president sort of fished his wish when he got a nominee, now you can quite literally say that. And I don't know if that is driving the conversation, but I know it is a part of the conversation that as the sort of process of nominating and confirming Supreme Court justices has become so politicized and so riven and so angry, you're going to see more and more justices who will never cross ideological lines, who are kind of locked in and who are chosen because they're locked in to a certain ideology. And I do think that that does, just going to your point, start to undermine the romantic notions we have about courts and about justices, about the idea that justices can evolve over years and that their positions can change once they're out of the hustle and bustle of political discourse. It looks like right now we have a court, and in the foreseeable future we're going to have a court where there's a lot less bipartisanship and a lot less evolution in one direction or another, that presidents are going to look for people who give them what they want, and they're going to get them.
We're speaking this hour with Dahlia Lithwick, a senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate.com, where she writes the jurisprudence column. And we're talking the Supreme Court this hour as we await the decision on the Affordable Care Act, and wondering how you feel about the Supreme Court and the confidence you have in it, and what you think of the job that they've been doing recently, and also, as we've been getting at here, some of the ways that the court has evolved during our lifetimes. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can send your email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert here. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we talk about the Supreme Court on as we await the ruling of the Affordable Care Act, which is said to be coming down to us by the end of the month. And we're talking with Dahlia Lithwick, a senior editor at Slate.com, where she writes the jurisprudence column. And an email here from Judy, who asks whether we as a people have any ability to deal with what we may regard as a very wrong ruling. And she adds that she thinks the court is always biased.
Well, it's a good question. I think it depends. That certainly depends on what your definition of wrong is, and we don't know yet what's going to happen. You can certainly see in the wake of Citizens United all sorts of efforts by various state legislatures, by Congress to pass the Disclose Act, efforts to even amend the Constitution to undermine what happened in Citizens United. So I think there's always legislative ability to correct what has happened in the healthcare decision. Again, it's so unclear what the court will do, and my own suspicion is they may do something so confusing, like strike down the individual mandate but leave the rest of the law. And provisions of the Health Care Act have already gone into effect, so it's going to be incredibly unclear when the law comes down what the immediate implications are. But if the question is, what can we do about the composition of the court, that's a really hard question. The court was structurally created by the framers to be immune from public disapproval of their decisions, and that's given us bad things like Dred Scott. It's given us good things like Brown v. Board of Education. So the idea is that just because the court does something unpopular, you cannot remove them. That said, I would just point out, and this is information that is strikingly important going into the election, the ages of four of the senior justices at the court now are 79, that's just Ruth Bader Ginsburg, 76, Antonin Scalia, 75, Anthony Kennedy, Stephen Breyer is 73. So this is a very rapidly aging court, and that's why elections matter. The difference between voting for Obama and Romney isn't just about the economy. It's not just about social values. It's about quite literally the composition of a court that is pushing 80.
So are you expecting, so you named three or four justices there, you're thinking the next 4 years we could see some major changes?
I think it's almost inevitable, simply actuarially speaking, I think it's almost inevitable that we are going to see some vacancies in the next 4 years. And it's really important to frame this understanding that this court is, in a very, very profound way, balanced between four liberals, four conservatives, one moderate conservative, that's Anthony Kennedy. He's one of the people I mentioned who is 75 right now. And so absolutely, I think the balance of the court is critically important going into the election. I think there's no question that if Justice Kennedy, who is that sort of centrifugal force at the court now, really the balance of most cases comes down to what Kennedy thinks. And if he should step down in the next 4 years, one of those presidents, be it Obama or Romney, is going to fundamentally reshape the Supreme Court and probably change the next 20, 30 years of jurisprudence in this country.
Well, that's if you're talking about the one justice. What if all four of them decide it's time? And, you know, that could be the whole ball game for...
Well, certainly, if for instance, Romney is elected and Ruth Bader Ginsburg were to step down, again, she's 79 now, then yes, it wouldn't almost matter what Anthony Kennedy does, because you would have presumably a conservative president replacing the most liberal justice on the court, and that really would be the whole ball game. Alternatively, if Obama were to win and Antonin Scalia were to step down, the same thing would happen. It wouldn't matter what that central position at the court was. But I think one thing to really think about as you frame this is that we have such gridlock in the current Senate right now. We can't approve district court judges. The lowest federal court judges are being filibustered. And so one of the questions going into the next election, and I don't have an answer, is that absent filibuster reform, absent serious reform of the process we are using to seat federal judges, it's not clear that anyone, be it Obama or Romney, is going to get a justice seated, because we are not confirming judges in this country right now.
Well, let's get to our phones, because we've got a lot of calls. We've got PJ first in Oshkosh. Hi, PJ.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. How about you?
Good, thanks. I was just wondering if there's ever been any talk about going away from lifetime appointments. I just feel that if you did get, you know, two or three judges that were appointed during a pendulum swing during, you know, more conservative time or liberal time, you're not stuck with that composition of the court for life.
It's a great question, PJ, and the truth is there has been growing momentum for an idea that was kind of born in the legal academy and that has now got some foothold, I think, in the legislature, that says that we should have an 18-year term limit for all the justices, and we should have a rolling confirmation every couple of years, and that way you don't have presidents who are appointing 3-4 justices in one go. Obviously, the problem is the Constitution doesn't provide for term limits. The Constitution is quite clear that justices serve for life as long as they're well-behaved. And well-behaved doesn't mean I don't like the decisions that they're issuing. It means as long as they're not really committing impeachable offenses. So you have a constitutional barrier to overcome. But I think more pointedly, there is an idea that is deeply enshrined in, you know, the framing and the way we think about the three branches of government that says that we don't term limit our justices precisely because we want them to be insulated from pressure, and we don't want them to have these short terms and to have the sense that they can't do what they seek to do. So I think that there's a real tension, not just an explicit constitutional tension, but an awful lot of people, including, I think, the justices themselves, who say that the idea of term limiting them is anathema to what we want in a constitutional system.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, PJ. And we move next to Dave in Wanakee. Hey, Dave.
Yes, hello. Clarence Thomas ruled on the Citizens United case. His wife was paid by those who brought suit. That seems like an apparent conflict of interest. Suppose that Clarence Thomas brought a suit to the Supreme Court himself. Is there anything that says he couldn't rule on that case? I mean, other than the standard judicial ethic that if you have a financial interest in the case, you're not allowed to rule on it. But that's a self-imposed thing.
So, Dave, your question really goes to the heart of the current controversy over judicial ethics and judicial behavior, and that is there is a judicial code of ethics. It is applied to all federal judges. It is only advisory. In other words, it's not mandatory as applies to the Supreme Court justices, and each of the justices, if there's an ethical question about their conduct, is left to decide for themselves whether they should recuse on a case. And this has been a burgeoning fight in the last couple of years. There haven't just been calls for Clarence Thomas to recuse himself on health care. There have also been equally vocal and angry calls for Elena Kagan to recuse herself. Don't forget, she served as the Solicitor General in the Obama Justice Department when the case was making its way to the court, so there were certainly arguments that she was compromised as well. But I think to Dave's basic question, which is, who is minding the store? Who is ensuring that these nine justices are really behaving according to the ethical rules? We have a very serious problem, not just because the judges and the justices make their own determination. The other eight justices have chosen to not weigh in, so it's really up to Clarence Thomas and Elena Kagan to determine whether they will recuse. There's a second problem, which is they don't explain themselves. In other words, they decide not to recuse, and they don't say, here is my rationale, so Americans don't get any kind of satisfactory answer about why. But the real problem, the deep, deep problem that Dave is flicking at, is that that undermines the credibility of the court. That when Americans think that a justice is in the tank for one side or another in a case, then you start to see the plummeting poll numbers that we're talking about. So whether it's Kagan or Thomas, and it differs from case to case, whether it's a financial conflict or some other conflict in terms of influence, there is, I think, a growing awareness, and that's partly the media is drawing attention to these questions, a growing awareness on the part of the public that the justices may be in the tank for one side or another, and that is undermining the confidence in the court as an institution.
Well, thank you for that call, Dave. And next we go to George from Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Hi. Yeah, I guess I'd like the guest's comment on that Republicans have been successful in getting very strong, staunch conservatives on the court, whether it's Alito or Scalia, Roberts, Thomas. But the liberals, the Democrats, have really kind of had to shoot for more moderate people like Breyer, Sotomayor, and even Kagan. many of whom actually have had experience doing corporate law and things like that. And so they're not able to really put their top liberal candidates up with hope of success. For instance, somebody like Cass Sunstein or Lawrence Tribe.
I think that, George, that's, I think you've exactly identified, you know, Ed Meese laid out in a speech before the American Bar Association in 1985 this dream of reshaping the entire court. He was Reagan's attorney general. And I think that it is absolutely true that the political right in this country has been laser focused for decades on putting very, very conservative, sort of party line Republicans onto the court. Both Clinton and Obama have been less interested in putting up analogous liberals on the court. They've been more interested in creating a diverse court. They've been more interested in putting up liberal moderates, but not the, you know, Alito of the left or the Scalia of the left. And so actually no less a figure than Justice John Paul Stevens likes to point out in speeches that every single person who has been replaced at the court for the last kind of few decades has been replaced by someone to their right. There isn't a parallel move on the court where people are being replaced by folks who are more liberal. And so there's no question that the center of gravity at the court has shifted rightward in the last few decades. I think underlying your question is why the Democrats haven't pushed as hard on the issue of the courts as Republicans have. And I think that just goes to a deep sense on the part of the left that the courts aren't where the action is anymore. I think on the left we have this notion that that the action is in the legislatures. And on the right, I think we have this notion that the liberals held in the 1960s, which is, of course, the courts is where you affect change. So we've just seen an inversion in the last few decades of what the focus is on. And the Democrats right now are not focused on the courts.
Well, thank you so much for that call, George. And next we have Kelly with us from River Falls. Hi, Kelly.
Well, good morning. I would point out that when we serve on jury duty, and I'm speaking to myself in particular, we take an oath and we take it very seriously, and we have to come up with a unanimous decision. And it seems to me like these folks are in the tank for one political party or the other, and they throw their oaths and their ethics right out the window, and they pander to political parties. The Supreme Court had no credibility in my household. I point out they made a big decision just recently in which a U.S. citizen tried to sue Donald Rumsfeld for being tortured while being held in captivity, and they wouldn't even hear the case. The same with several detainees who were cleared for release. They won't hear the case. So not only are they disingenuous, they're emotional cowards. They won't take on tough issues. So I think the Supreme Court is in the tank. It's a complete disaster. And I just change the law. They have to come up with a unanimous decision, and that'll make them go away because those guys couldn't agree on anything.
All right. Thank you, Kelly. And Dahlia.
I will push back on one thing that Kelly says. I think it's really important to emphasize that even though we are looking at a court that is quite partisan, that is split 5-4, that on the major, major decisions of our time, we see a lot of 5-4s, it's really crucial to look at in the aggregate, the number of 8-1 decisions that come out of this court. For Kelly, the number of unanimous decisions. In other words, it is not the case that every single case comes down in polarized 5-4 fashion, and in fact, you will often see, as we did in some of the decisions that came down yesterday and last week, some interesting 6-3 configurations where liberals and conservatives are in bed together. So it's worth noting that this court is not universally 5-4 split on everything. That said, Kelly's certainly not wrong that the sense I think that the American people have is that the five conservatives on the Roberts Court are pushing a certain agenda. The four liberals on the Roberts Court are pushing an agenda. And I think Kelly really does speak for that New York Times poll where folks just think once you have a court that is acting as a purely partisan political body, you should just stop calling it a court and start calling it a school board and stop trying to fool all of us. So I do think that his comment resonates with what we're seeing in the polling numbers.
So as we wait for this decision to come down, how important do you think it's going to be for the perception of the courts and the public and our indicators about which way the court is headed?
Well, I think that any way this decision comes down, there's going to be enormous public blowback. The public has been deeply invested in this lawsuit from the beginning. One of the interesting things that we didn't talk about in the New York Times approval rating is that even though Americans really, really think the court is partisan and political, they also really generally hate the health care law and overwhelmingly want to see 41% of those polled in last week's poll say that the court should strike down the entire law. So there is a very, very strange situation where you have a conservative court poised to strike down a law that everybody hates. And the question is, really, is there going to be a problem with that? And that's what we're going to have to wait and see how that plays out. I do think that the string of decisions from Bush v. Gore to Citizens United to the health care cases, and next term, just briefly, the court is going to hear an affirmative action case, probably a voting rights case, and very likely now, I think, a gay marriage case. So the best is yet to come in terms of hot-button issues that are coming barreling down. And I do think, if you look at the net sense that the court has inserted itself into everything, and that if those are all 5-4 decisions, the court is really, really going to have to deal with a public that is quite worried.
And we are out of time, Dahlia. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your being with us today.
My pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick, she writes the jurisprudence column at Slate.com, where she's a senior editor and legal correspondent. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.